introduce you to today's guest, Dr. James McCleary. Dr. McCleary has a master's and a doctorate in clinical psychology. Has also attended the Loyola University Chicago School of Law. James McCleary, you've spent a lot of time in school.
Yes, I have. That is what I found out, come to find out. It's been because I was told I was stupid so often when I was younger.
Hmm.
I tried to prove that I wasn't.
Well, I think you've proved it several times, but let's start with that. Let's start with the kinds of things that adults, parents say to children and how it impacts them. You were told you were stupid when you were young. What were the circumstances?
Well, I was born in 1948, and the geography that I grew up in was about 10 to 15 blocks wide and about 30 blocks in length.
Hmm.
It was the black neighborhood at the time.
Okay.
And aggression, violence, and keeping in your place was the order of the day. And I was fortunate enough, or unfortunate, as you may know in the news, to go to a Catholic school where I learned how to read and write.
Hmm.
And the nuns and the priest, they told us that we were not going to learn as much as typical white kids could learn.
Huh.
And my parents constantly told me that I was stupid, and I think it was a way to motivate me to study harder.
Did it?
And yeah, it did.
Hmm.
And the teachers told me that, too. It did, but it also created a cloud of shame where I really couldn't enjoy the fruits of, you know, my labor.
Of course. The nuns who were telling you that you weren't going to learn as much or as well or as thoroughly, I mean, how did they put that together for you?
Well, they told me that my brain was not as big as the dominant population, that black kids' brains were smaller. I was even told that in graduate school.
Hmm. In graduate school?
Absolutely.
Wow.
By a pharmacology professor. When I got a perfect score on an exam, he just couldn't figure it out. But essentially, it was just a way to let us know that we should stay in our place and not aspire for much. And I believe that to some degree. And I worked harder and harder trying to disprove it, but underneath I still believe some of it.
Well, and you know, it's almost like a never-ending cycle. I mean, the harder you work, the harder you think you should work, and then the more they're telling you what they're telling you. I can't imagine that there were long periods of peace in your life as you were growing up. What did you do for fun? Did you have fun?
Well, yes, I was a child, so I did a lot of things that children do.
Okay.
Played baseball, football, and all kinds of exploratory games, as most kids would do. And that fun, generally, in the African-American neighborhood, when you're a certain height, people don't bother you too much. There's intimidation. But when you get to be a certain height, then the competition begins to occur, and generally it expresses itself as aggression and violence to establish some sense of dominance.
And what height were you as you became a teenager?
Generally, I was tall and skinny.
Mm.
So when I got to be about 12 years old, somewhere around 7th, 8th grade, that's when I really had to toughen up.
How so?
What we used to do is shadow box every day. Essentially, that's what we did.
Okay.
Every day we fought. And some of that was just to let off that steam of poverty and hunger and lack, but some of it was hormonal also.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was like gladiator school, if you will.
Hmm. And your height at that point?
I was 5'11".
Okay.
Moving on up to 6 feet.
In what grade were you in?
I was somewhere between 7th and 8th grade.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, tall and skinny.
Tall and skinny.
Yeah, it was.
As you were growing up, what lessons were you taught about being a, well, we know what you were taught about being a black boy. Your brain was smaller and it was only but so much you were going to get. But as you grew into being a young man, did those lessons change? Who were your role models for what it meant to be a man and an African-American man in particular?
Well, they were mixed. Again, because our area was smaller and opportunity was not as great as the whole of the culture, resources were small. And so there was a certain amount of aggression and violence, and crime was seen as a career alternative. And so some of my role models happened to be the older men who were driving around in the Cadillacs and seemed to have, you know, fancy clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of my role models were the people of the day, like Martin Luther King and, at the time, Cassius Clay, who then became Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
As I got older, it was scholars in the world. And so I had a mixed sense of what it was to be a man. One was to stand in a place of integrity, and another was to stand in a place of power.
Well, it's interesting because you know the mixture between the guys rolling around with the fancy clothes and the Cadillacs and Martin Luther King, for example, those are very different messages. And so for you, what did integrity look like and what did power look like?
Well, integrity looks like speaking the truth. And you could tell that because the way a man looked when he was telling the truth, he looked very congruent. His body, the tone of his voice, and the words he spoke had import. And I aspired to have that myself.
Okay.
It felt somehow internally good to be in a place of speaking that kind of truth in that way. And then power was always a need because very quickly we had to form into groups. Now, we called ourselves clubs, but essentially they were units of protection that, looked somewhat like a gang.
Okay. What were the things that you aspired to, perhaps as you were in your later teens, early 20s?
I was told at that time, and even now, get an education, get a good job, and at the highest pinnacle, have a profession. And those were the kind of things that I strove for. I didn't have mentorship for that, but I still strove for that.
Okay, so you wanted that for yourself as well as people telling you that that's what you should go after.
I did.
Okay.
Somehow inside of myself, I just didn't, the hyper-masculinity that was being exhibited, there was something not quite right about it. I just didn't like the fact that you had to hurt people or intimidate and dominate people's spirit in order to be in a powerful position, and that's what the crime lords and the crime bosses did.
How do you go from that young man and that sort of relatively small construct to the man who is a designer and leader in a four-day training at Folsom Prison in California? That seems like kind of a leap. How did you get from there to prison, but in a good way?
That's a very good question. I say I don't have, I didn't have complete mentors, but I did have mentors. And one of them was Father George Clemens. I don't know if you know him, but he was the first priest to adopt children.
Hmm.
He pissed off the church and the Pope, but he did it anyway.
Okay.
He was a civil rights leader, African-American priest, and one thing he did was give us a key to the gym when we were just going into high school. And he said, and because it was much safer to play inside than it was on the basketball courts, you know, on the outside.
I can imagine.
And so all we had to do was show up at the rectory at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and he'd give us an address, and we'd show up where that address was, and it was all over the city. And it might be in a nursing home, it might be at a university attending a lecture, it might be sitting in a high school with other ethnic group of kids. So it could be a lot of different things. I think exposure.
That's amazing that he exposed all of you to so many different venues and gave you a way to really think about perhaps the breadth of the world that you hadn't had before.
I think that's actually what did save me, because the other young men that I grew up with, most of them were dead after a while. And the group that I grew up within this club with, and we were privy to this form of mentorship and exposure, many of them went on to become professionals.
Well, again, tell me about Folsom Prison and that training. What did you hope to accomplish? I mean, so many people, as you know, once you go to prison, they sort of, society wants to throw you away. I mean, they don't want to invest anything in you. And when you come out, they still don't want to invest much in you. So tell me about this 4-day training. What were you able to accomplish and why bother, quite frankly?
Well, I hear you, and I hope you know the statistics. There's close to 500,000 people in the U.S. prisons today, and probably 60% of them are African American. And once that's a permanent treadmill of disenfranchisement, as you know.
Indeed.
When you come out, recidivism is as high as 65% to 70%, depending on what state you're in. But what we saw was a way to demystify and rewrite the narrative for what we found to be hypermasculinity in males.
Okay.
And it's ever present in the gang culture in the inner city, but especially in prison. And so what we did was use another mythopoetic way to allow for the narrative to be told by each man. And that man told a story and learned to find places in his story where he was a hero, and to understand places in his story where he was the anti-hero. And he, in all the cases that we've worked with, and we've done this for 15 years, men prefer the hero to the anti-hero.
Not surprising. Dr. McCleary, I'm going to interrupt you right here. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to hear more about the work that you were able to do in this prison and other prisons, if it's gone outside of that particular Folsom Prison area. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Dr. James McCleary. Don't go away. We will return. Hello, everyone. This is Pamela Brewer welcoming you back to this edition of Mind Talk. And I continue my conversation with Dr. James McCleary, who holds graduate degrees in health law and clinical psychology. And right now we're discussing his work at Folsom Prison in California. Dr. McCleary, 4-day training, was that enough to change the lives of these men?
Yes, and we've actually filmed a 4-day intensive probably early, mid 12:15.
Dr. McCleary, I'm going to ask you to speak directly into the phone.
Okay. We're going to release that documentary showing some of the techniques that we use.
Wonderful.
What happens is we develop trust, and that develops a bond. And those are the things that are missing in healthy people, but especially healthy males. They generally have to develop a bond that's unhealthy with a mentor whose idea is to dominate and to take advantage in the community or in the prison. And so this trust develops a bond not only with men from the outside, but with men in the inside. What has happened is we have all the races and all the crime organizations represented in these groups and trainings, which has never been done before. It's like a gang summit. And what happens is we sit in a circle. We develop trust by telling stories, the story of your life.
Okay.
And at that point, when an Aryan Nation brother looks at a Blood or a Crip or an Asian triad and sees that their story is the same as any other man, then they learn to find a commonality between the two. The trust develops because things that have previously not been said out loud or certainly to another member of another group is said out loud, witnessed, and appreciated. And this develops this kind of trust and connectedness that continues.
Now, is this training mandatory, or do people self-select?
Not at all.
No,
it is. In fact, no one comes into the training or the groups unless they've been vouched for.
Okay.
And we've specifically not had any mandatory or any kudos or points that go towards parole, because we don't want men coming in for reasons other than for personal growth and behavioral transformation. Although a letter from anyone who's participated in these trainings goes a long way with the parole board now, because they do recognize that their success. Aggression and violence has been reduced, and that's because the men who sit in these circles are at the top of the food chain in these organizations, and they've learned different ways to settle competition.
Have you named this training?
It is called Inside Circle.
Okay.
And there we have a non-for-profit Inside Circle Foundation. We are also in San Quentin. And moving into Solanos, and hope to be moving into the Illinois prison system shortly. And other groups have sprung from this. The Jericho Project is in 3 prisons in Massachusetts. The Circle of Truth is in Wisconsin. And another group is also in California. And all the men who have started these other organizations, which we encourage, have been through the training process from Inside Circle Foundation. It is a similar organization.
You know, it's extraordinary because, you know, the day before they come into this 4-day training, they're in prison. And the day after they end this four-day training. They're still in prison. And you talk about these men who they're vouched for, but they also essentially self-select. And you talk about personal transformation and growth. And that's not how people think about people in prison. And certainly, it's not how people view men in prison. And certainly, not how people view African-American men in prison. And I know you bring in all races and all groups, but I mean, it really is quite a concept as you talk about it.
Well, what we do, one of the requirements is to drop your, we call it armor. And they drop that armor for the time that they're in the session.
Okay.
No one is made to do anything, but you would be surprised by watching someone who speaks their truth, the relief that is palpable you feel from that. It's sort of like being in church and having someone be witness. You know, you want to step up and, you know, testify yourself.
Right.
Yeah. It is a energetic process where when the tension of how you are meets the tension of a want and a desire to change, there's a whole lot of energy in that moment. And what we do is, through techniques, is allow that energy to propel a man through his resistance.
Have you had an opportunity to do any studies on the rate of recidivism among the men who complete your program?
We have begun to do that now. We have some data now that shows that we've got about a 75% rate. So only about 25% of the men who have gone through these trainings go back to prison.
That's extraordinary.
Yes. And again, these aren't soldiers. These are lieutenants and shot callers in these organizations. But we teach them cognitive and behavioral skills, as well as this this energetic way to embrace your own medicine, is what we call it. Whatever your unique gift, talent, or value is, we discover that through the groups, and that's what we call medicine. And when a man embraces his medicine, he's enthusiastic about, you know, letting that medicine be used to heal other people.
You know, it's I'm just thinking about how extraordinary this is, and certainly the preliminary research is breathtaking in terms of how successful you've been able to be in these men's lives. And it sounds like when they come out of prison, their definition of what it means to be a man is very different. It's perhaps been transformed into something else.
That's absolutely correct. It's been transformed into a way where they've restored the part of themselves that maybe their grandmother saw in them. And they've embraced it, and they've cultivated it. And so that's part of the program, is to help cultivate whatever values, skills, talent a man has, and help them, you know, channel it into something that is visible and tangible. And so when they come out, we have catchment groups also. Because, you know, that's a pretty dangerous time.
Yes.
Someone comes out of prison, they've got no identification and no money, and the only thing they have to go back to are the resources that they use to get in.
Right, right. Now, you talk about having worked with men from different cultures, different races, different groups within the prison system, but you've done travel yourself to other places, yes?
Yes.
And you've met certainly men and women in other places. Talk to us about some of the travel that you've engaged in.
Well, this work, this kind of transformative work, anybody can learn. So it's not an egalitarian thing. Anyone can learn the principles of knowing self and then modeling that and teaching that to other people.
Okay.
And so I've been blessed to be able to go to Europe and South Africa and South America and participate in those kinds of trainings that utilize the same kind of techniques, but with men and women, with children, with leadership development in kids in school. There's a program called the Band of Brothers that I help formulate in London.
Hmm.
And we're actually doing some of that here in Chicago, where the city of Chicago is providing us with 20 counselors from the various social agencies.
Huh.
We're taking them through this same kind of training. And then a few months later, the young men that go see these counselors, they're 18 to 22, we're going to take them through a training where the counselors now are going to be on staff. And so they will be implementing a lot of these techniques. There's a group called BAM, Becoming a Man, which is a social organization here in Chicago. And they have counselors that they have throughout the city at schools. And all of them have been required to go through this training. We've worked with the Interrupters, and the Interrupters are those men and women who are on the streets,
hmm,
interventions with gangs.
Hmm.
We work with them. These are teachable tools. This is not something that is, not out of the, you don't have to have an advanced degree or some kind of unique behavioral intuitive skill to do this. Anybody can learn these.
Well, it sounds like the real skill you have to have is caring and compassion.
You named it. Caring, compassion for self, which allows you to care and have compassion for others. If you can see the value in yourself, you'll be able to spot it in someone else.
And so it really is important to be able to know yourself and value yourself and hold on to that, because sometimes there are going to be people around who aren't going to help you hold on to that.
That's right. And so that's a key thing, knowing yourself. And to know yourself, you have to be aware of your thinking, so that's where that cognitive place comes in.
Mm-hmm.
How have you arranged your patterns of thinking, and how can you test that with the reality of what's actually going on and not just the story you're running in your head?
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of your emotions and have some way to manage and regulate? That's what it's being the professional executive coaches are using in the corporate world. It's called emotional IQ, emotional intelligence.
You know, actually, I have two questions in my head at once, so why don't I try one at a time? As you have traveled all over the world and you've met men in many different cultures, many different environments, is there anything that you have experienced that men typically, no matter where they're from or what they believe or who they believe in, are there things that they typically have in common? Are there things that are particularly different across cultures?
Depending on where I am, whether it is a modernized setting or a more indigenous or urban setting, what I found is that in the indigenous setting, because I'm doing quite a bit of work with the Lakota Sioux on the Pine Ridge Reservation, they are imbued with ceremony and spirituality, and they've been cut off from the way of expressing their emotional self, and they've been enculturated with shame. So South Africa, I found the same thing. There's been this disenfranchisement, which has bred this self-hatred and shame. And but a lot of ceremony and spirituality, and it's just kind of taking the tenets of their spirituality,
mm-hmm,
and letting them use them as tools in this modern way of understanding how you may show up, because you're propelled by hidden agendas, propelled by emotional.
Interesting. Dr. McCleary, we're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, I'd like to focus more on the experience of shame and how that shows up in men's lives and what you would like men to do with that. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk. We will be right back to continue this conversation about men the world over. Don't go away. Back. This is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk and a continued conversation with James McCleary. Dr. McCleary, would you speak directly into the phone as you talk to us about the impact of shame in men and what you would like men to know and perhaps think about?
Well, I think there are two types of shame. There is a healthy shame, which is a recognition that you may be violating your own principles or stepping over the boundaries and principles of others.
Mm.
And with that recognition, then you kind of back off. And then there's the toxic shame, where there is a belief about yourself that you think is innate.
Okay.
And this keeps brewing, and all the signals around you, you are identifying as saying, yes, you are this bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And people never change. And that develops into a kind of rage, either a kind of rage or a kind of deep apathy and depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of rage that I've seen, you know, in the disenfranchised people, it turns to aggression and violence. And that is a way to at least have some sense of empowerment, because toxic shame is a disempowering feeling.
It's exhausting. So for the men who are listening right now, or for the friends or partners of men who are living in this toxic shame, and I think you can kind of tell, I mean, you can almost feel when somebody's buried in that, what can they do, if anything?
Well, again, my philosophy is that you can't do these kinds of things alone. You can't have self-awareness, and you can't really walk the road back to a restorative place unless you have support.
Okay.
So seeking out support is the best thing. And the groups, whether it's in church or an organization like the Mankind Project or an organization like the Underground Railroad, Inward Journey. These are the kinds of organizations that allow people to sit in a circle, in a group, and be able to download the things that are bothering them in a safe and organized way. And once something is witnessed, my grandmother always told me it heals faster. Otherwise, it just festers.
That's very true. You know, I can't tell you, and I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you, the number of men that I may work with in my office who, when asked about emotions, they don't have any.
Yeah.
Talk about that, if you would.
We get taught as men in our culture to not show emotion. And that happens right in the schools, or it happens because of an over-feminized approach to dealing with young males. When there's a male and a female in the house, a young child or boy gets to see both sides of the ways to express emotion, and then integrate the two. And as we move further and further into a more conscious world and society, that notion is being taught in schools, this kind of, what are your emotions? Express your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And men are beginning to do that. And they're finding that it's much healthier, with less hypertension, less cholesterol, and less drinking and having animosity with your wife.
And less depression and less of a whole lot of stuff.
Absolutely.
Speaking of being, yes.
So I think the key is the expression and a way to express it in a healthy way.
You know, we're talking about expression and emotions and shame, and, you know, certainly we know that more and more men are literally coming out and saying, yes, I'm gay. And certainly in this country, that's been a charged, painful place to be in terms of, not internally necessarily, but in terms of how others treat you. And so my question to you is, in today's time, certainly more and more voices are applauding those men who come out. They're applauding them for their honesty. In the Black community, though, it has long been a real risk and a real challenge to come out. Is that changing, do you think?
You know, I think it's changing just because of the momentum of the exposure to it.
Okay.
I still believe that as I see that hypermasculinity comes with heavy judgment, and a heavy enculturation that men don't express feelings.
Right.
And that to be a man means that you have to have a preference for the opposite sex. And that is certainly not what a man is. But if you're taught that way, you're going to have these beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And dismantling those beliefs is a way for you to put your judgments in perspective and include more information that broadens your belief system. Closed beliefs, narrow beliefs, is what causes the tension between people.
Sure.
But those beliefs are broadened because of additional information, people get smarter, they become more connected.
You've talked about, and we've been talking about for this conversation, men and what it is to be a man. So what is it to be a man? What does that mean?
I think being a man has got less to do with your geneticism than it has to do with being congruent with what you're thinking and feeling and how you're behaving. And being open to and exposed to ways to broaden what you're thinking and be open to looking at how your thinking may be limited. Being open to how you can actually use your emotions as tools, because anger is a great motivator.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up the phone or study when you don't want to or go to work when you don't want to. So emotions are a spectrum. At the dysfunctional end, they just get turned inward, and how do I soothe myself? Whereas if at the productive end of the spectrum, how can I use this energy to make things work? And so that kind of teaching is not happening either in the homes or in the schools. But it's beginning to happen with these circles and these different groups that are promoting that kind of education.
Talk about some of the groups. You mentioned Mankind Project and Inward Journey. And talk about some of these groups. What are they doing, and how do people find out about them?
Well, all of these groups are on the website. You can go on the internet and look up the Mankind Project or the Inward Journey or Inside Circle Foundation. All of these organizations are on the internet.
Okay.
And what they do is invite the man to look at their own life and see the parts of themselves that they'd like to improve and the parts of themselves they'd like to examine and get some real understanding, self-understanding about why they may continue to do the same thing over and over again when they don't want to. And once they, if that appeals to them, which it does to many men,
mm-hmm.
check out these groups and go through these trainings. And the training allows them to get in a group of like-minded people who begin to discuss who they are and why they are and support the other person in doing the same. And so a person's life gets to unfold in this group without having to conform to the group, which is different from what might happen if you join a church. And anyone who wants to join a particular religion, I'm happy mm-hmm. for them to do so.
Mm-hmm.
These are non-denominational settings.
Okay.
Where no matter what you believe, you're free to believe these things and talk about them. And you'd be surprised if you talk long enough about something in yourself. You begin to notice the fallacies or the truth in it yourself. You don't need other people to point them out.
Right. You kind of get it on your own.
Yes. And it's that kind of regularity that happens. I'm in lots of different groups that, you know, I at least meet once a month somewhere. And that keeps me tuned up.
And in keeping you tuned up, how does that impact the rest of your life?
Well, it helps me to be truthful about what I'm doing, what I'm telling myself, and how I'm showing up in the world. Because I may have a good game. All of us have good games in tricking ourselves to get what we want.
Indeed.
And by sitting in the group and explaining how I've done something, you know, I see the eyebrows raised because something doesn't smell right. And I trust the eyebrow raising enough to say, what did you pick up?
Mm-hmm.
And people give me their feedback. And, you know, what fits and what doesn't is not expected that I have to make fit.
It sounds like it takes a lot of courage to be in these groups.
It takes courage, but courage is nurtured by trust.
Okay.
And that's the cornerstone of any of these groups is trust.
We are going to go to a break in just a moment, but when we come back, I would like for you to talk particularly to the single parents who are listening and sort of talk them through what your concerns might be or what you might hope for them to be able to instill in their young male children. And certainly the young children of today are experiencing things in such, in a lot of ways, really painful ways, but certainly there's just more data coming in. And so there's a lot more to deal with as young girls and young boys. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, again, I'd like for you to talk to the single parents who are listening and talk to them about what you would like to have happen, you would like for them to think about in terms of their little boys as they're teaching them to become men. We're going to take a break and we will return. My name is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and we will return to this conversation with James McCleary. Don't go. And we're back. This is Pamela Brewer. I continue my conversation with James McCleary. And again, Dr. McCleary holds graduate degrees in health law and clinical psychology. He has worked with management teams in various educational, corporate, and government institutions to provide insight into clarity of purpose. He provides communication tools to recalibrate the resources needed for more efficient accomplishment of goals. So that's more than a mouthful, but certainly a life full. Talk to the single parents who are listening now who have young male children and may be worried. What do you want them to think about? What would you like for them to know?
Well, I think that, you know, the old African accent, it takes a village to raise a child, is just so true. And so I would ask them to reach out and put their kids in, allow their kids to be exposed to different groups, whether it's a youth group at the church, the Boy Scouts, a community purpose group at school, something that the group is being mentored and exposed to providing a useful purpose somewhere, learning skill sets to be useful. It may be a project that has to be completed or will be completed, because in those settings, they have goals to look forward to. They have places to download and talk. Children aren't necessarily, unless it's an extraordinarily wonderful setting, they're not going to tell their parent everything that's going on with them.
Right.
And that even if they did, the parent may not have the skill set or the emotional detachment not to shut the child down through judgments or disapproval or whatever it is. But within a group setting, if it's a good one, they're allowed to download and then get back to them these things that they might be thinking about or doing and see what might not be healthy or healthy for them. And primarily, they learn to set goals and to move towards those goals that have a larger purpose. If they don't have that, they're never going to be expiring for the mutuality of purpose that the people who are good members of a community do. And so I'd ask that they explore different settings where their children can sit in these kinds of groups and be a part of.
And I think that the Mankind Project has a group for young men, does it not?
It does. It's called Boys to Men. And the same kind of emotional literacy that men learn in the Mankind Project with other men, these young men learn also. And again, it's not just the emotional literacy, but it is the purpose. Because each of these young men, they develop their own mission in life, which can change. But they develop their own mission in life. And that's what provides the juice for me to get up in the morning and keep moving.
Gotcha. You know, as we're talking about or talking to single parents and now parents in general, certainly we all know that this is a very stressful world and it's a very stressful time. And we often, I think, as parents of children, may not think about the import or the impact of the words that we speak to our children. Can you just touch on that again for a moment?
Give me the question again.
The power of words, particularly on children, that adults may often, under stress, who knows what they're going to say, but it's powerful. And I'd just like for you to address that for a moment.
Well, I mean, developmentally, these young people are trying to discover their own self-identity. And they feel vulnerable and fragile and on the one hand in trying to do that, and full of spit and fire on the other, convinced that they know how to do that. And so the words and the invitation for both of those sides to show up, they begin to trust and respect, so that when they are hell-bent on something and they hear it from a respected adult, they begin to question it themselves.
Mm.
Rather than, I'm being forced not to be who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are speaking towards a dream or a vision they may have, instead of being that vision being downplayed, that'll never happen, you can't do this, or this is the impossible road you have to take to get there.
Or you're stupid, you have a small brain.
Exactly. They get encouraged to outline what that dream looks like and the steps it takes. And, you know, even if it's a small dream, a dream that is they could aspire to and get to easily, once they've done that,
mm-hmm.
they tend to broaden the scope of their own dreams. So it's a nurturing process. It's a support and cultivating process. And it takes someone who cares about the individual but is not attached in the same emotional sense that a parent may be.
Okay. Okay. And to the men who are listening, who perhaps are still locked up inside of themselves, what would you like for them to think about?
Well, I would say if any part of you hears what I'm saying and touches you in any way, rings true, go on the site and check out the Mankind Project. And even if that doesn't appeal to you, it'll give you the kind of information that allows you to search other groups that might. And so I say, hear me. And I say, you don't have to live in that cell alone or have your cell as small as it is, because there is hope for you. And there's places out there you can go to unlock your own gate.
And with the thank you for that. With the Mankind Project, there are different kinds of training. I think I saw on the website something called Inner King Training. Is that part of Mankind Project?
Yeah, yes, it is. And I want you to understand that the Mankind Project is not. It is a international organization.
Okay.
That allows everybody to participate at the rate they want to participate. So someone in the Mankind Project who went through the initial gateway training,
mm-hmm.
which is called the New Warrior Training Adventure,
okay.
they are free to develop trainings that they want to offer to other people.
Okay.
And the Mankind Project takes a look at it and says, yes, we support this.
Ah, okay. And so
the Inner King Training was developed by someone who, or somebodies who went through the initial initiatory weekend.
When you look at the world that we're in now, and a lot of people have said that it seems to be, quite frankly, a nastier place. I mean, the just sort of the spirit and the vibe of so many people is just really dreadful, to put it mildly. Do you have any thoughts about how that is? And do you have any thoughts about what a future might hold?
Well, it escapes me who spoke these words of wisdom, but never doubt that a small number of people can have a huge impact in the world.
Mm.
And I firmly believe that. It was a small group of us who first went into prison.
Indeed.
Really not having an idea of what we were doing or how we were going to do it, but just the belief
mm-hmm.
that if we were ourselves, these men would see it. And that's kind of carried me through everywhere.
Mm.
I've been in the back rooms in Ireland with, you know, I won't name the groups, but Protestants and the Catholics. I've been in the back room in South Africa with the old regime of the secret police and the old gorillas in the ANC. And I've been in back rooms with people who were entrenched in the belief that they should hurt the other person sitting across the table. Either bend to the will of this belief, or you will suffer the consequences.
Gotcha.
And I certainly am no Superman, nor am I some kind of prophet, but when they can hear me, see me, mediate in a way that is truthful, simplistic, and honest, and ascribe to that same formula, they begin to open up the tolerance of listening. And that encourages trust, and trust begets trust.
That is just absolutely extraordinary to think about the places that you've been, the people that you've worked to, with and through, and that principle of trust begets trust. If you show up and you show up with honesty and integrity, then that goes a long way to create the change that you would like and deserve in yourself and others.
Absolutely. And every person, when they are in the midst of their own congruity, that is as powerful as watching Martin Luther King give "I Have a Dream" speech.
Mm.
Every individual is just that potent when they are being who they are. And that is a modeling process for someone else to say, they can do that, and all I have to do is be who I am. Let me find out what that looks like.
Right. Let me go there.
Yeah.
Dr. McCleary, I have to thank you again so much for taking your time out to talk with us. And, you know, anytime that you've got something you're working on that you would like to share with the Mind Talk listeners, I absolutely encourage and welcome you to do so.
Thank you very much.
And again, the Mankind Project is one of the places that you would recommend people take a look. Is that the best way for people to get in touch with you if they would like to?
They could if they want to, yes. Everyone knows me in that organization.
Okay.
And also Inside Inward Journey, which is a training for African Americans.
Okay.
And that is been exclusively developed to move through the self-victimization and internalized shame piece.
And how one just looks them up on the website, Inward Journey?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Terrific. Dr. James McCleary, thank you so very much for being with us today.
You are quite welcome. Thank you.
All righty. You take care. Thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. This program is not intended to take the place of professional care, including medical and mental health services. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And for more information about Mind Talk, go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable.